I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Moshe Barel, Israeli scientific agronomist and grower of olives and maker of olive oil in southern Israel near Gaza. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Chanukah Sameach, a happy, healthy holiday of Chanukah. This is the first morning of Chanukah, the festival of lights we usually associate with evening. But if you have 8 nights, then of course you also must have 8 days. And since this is one of my absolutely favorite Jewish holidays, and there are many to choose from, we really do need to enjoy the days as well as those 8 crazy nights. And in order to enjoy the days, what better way than to spend it right here with the Two Jewish Radio Show? You know, I always find the way that themes both Jewish and more general coalesce in this season is particularly inspiring. The Hanukkah themes of religious freedom, both of religious observance and from religious persecution, the historical story of the victory of the weak over the strong, the few over the many, the righteous remnant over the tyrant's huge army, the underdog Jews over the dominant oppressors, these are fresh each year, a promise of hope in the face of seemingly overwhelming repression. These Hanukkah themes never grow old and never diminish in importance. As long as there are people who cannot worship as they wish, we will need the central message of this Festival of Lights to bring the promise of miraculous redemption. And of course, Hanukkah's insistence on the existence of miracles, both long ago and right now, touches a responsive chord in anyone who retains some of that youthful wonder that helps brighten our lives in this season of short but enjoyable days and long nights. The word Hanukkah itself is revealing. It means dedication, the kind of dedication we owe to our spouses, children, and friends. But it comes from the same root as education, chinuch in Hebrew. Hanukkah celebrates both the dedication that we must make a center point of our lives and the education that makes us wise and able to grow and change and mature. And of course, Hanukkah is just flat-out fun and filled with delicious fried food and silly dreidel games. In fact, you can make a case that one of the paramount Jewish skills in life is the ability to fry a good latke, which just happens to be my own central culinary accomplishment to date. As my wife Wendy says, I know how to keep the oil at a gentle high heat. A great skill, at least on Hanukkah. By the way, my kids have a fabulous version of dreidel called Texas Hold'em Dreidel that combines the skills of poker and the random silliness of dreidel into what is actually a truly fun game. And all of this is to remind us that Nes Gadol Hayasham, a great miracle happened there in Israel at this time of year around the holiday of Hanukkah. To play us in this morning on the first day of Hanukkah, in that spirit, here's a classic Italian version of the hymn Maoz Tzur, Rock of Ages, first notated by Benedetto Marcello in the 1700s and sung beautifully here by the Zamir Chorale of Boston.
Amen.
That was Ma'oz Tzur, the wonderful Hanukkah hymn, as the Italian Jews sing it. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Moshe Barel, will explain how in Israel they actually make olive oil, a crucial element in the Hanukkah story after all, and also tell us about agriculture in Israel today more generally. When we come back in a moment on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. He's agronomist Moshe Barel. This is the first time I've had an expert, really an expert on agriculture in Israel today on Too Jewish in 10 plus years, 10 and a half years of the show. Boker Tov and welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about what you do and where you do it. It has something to do with olives, I believe.
Yes, I have about 700 tree olives. They are for oil production. And every year I bottle about 2,000 bottles of olive oil.
All right, so this is something I'm dying to know. What's the difference between extra virgin olive oil and olive oil?
Usually what they mean by extra virgin, this is the first oil that came out of the oiling machines.
So the first press is the extra virgin.
The first is extra virgin, and after that is virgin oil, what we call.
In the Torah, it talks about Shemen Zayit Zach a lot. What does that mean, really?
What they mean by Shemen Zayit Zach is this is the best part of the Shemen, because in that days, they used to separate the oil from the other liquids that came with by letting it stay on the ground in a hole.
Like a big vat, like an oil vat.
Yeah, in a big stone vat. So all the sediments are going down and the oil going up. And what you extract very high is the very good oil. And this was what they meant, Shemen Zayit Zach, that the oil is only pure olive oil, without any sediments in it.
The real extra virgin for the days of the temple and the menorah and Hanukkah and all that
stuff. Yes, what they used to put on the kings.
So how long does it take for an olive oil press to produce usable oil?
In the Tanakh days, in the old days, it will take a couple days. And now in the modern machine, this is instant.
You know, it's funny, we think about Hanukkah and there wasn't enough oil to burn in the menorah in the temple for only one day, and it took a whole week to make more oil. Why would it have taken, I've always wondered about this as a rabbi, why would it have taken a full week in those days?
Well, it was a kind of a miracle. You can't argue with miracles.
We will talk much more and much more in depth with Moshe Barel about agronomy and agriculture in Israel today when we come back this morning on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442, again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or kfel, please email us at 2jewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at 2jewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. An unusual Hanukkah present came to the Jews this year for car lovers, and it comes from a most unlikely source. It's no secret that Henry Ford was a notorious anti-Semite, and the Ford Company's dealings with the Nazi Party during the Holocaust are well documented. Ford even financed and published an anti-Semitic newspaper for many years. It was called the Dearborn Independent back in the 1920s. It even serialized the notorious anti-Semitic forgery, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which Henry Ford himself believed in completely. But the Ford Company story has changed drastically in recent decades. Their donation of a rare 500-year-old Torah scroll to a suburban Detroit synagogue and the appointment of Jewish chief operating officer demonstrate a marked shift in the company's narrative when it comes to Jews. That shift started in the late 1940s when Henry Ford's grandson, Henry Ford II, took over the company. He began hiring minorities. But it wasn't until 1977 that a man named Mervyn Manning became the first Jewish officer of Ford. However, it was during those years that Ford II already had started a period of repentance for the car maker, becoming the friend of notable Jewish philanthropists like Max Fischer, may he rest in peace, and making large charitable gifts to the then United Jewish Appeal. Today in Detroit, the Ford Motor Company and the billionaire family are seen as major contributors to the Jewish Federation and the Jewish Community Center, and members of the Ford family and top executives have been honored by local Jewish groups. In 1999, Benson Ford Jr., a great-grandson of the auto tycoon, purchased the 500-year-old Torah scroll and donated it to Temple Shir Shalom in West Bloomfield, Michigan. That Torah was written in hiding between 1492 and 1560 in Spain or perhaps Portugal, where it was, of course, illegal to practice Judaism after the expulsion. The newest chapter in the long history of Ford and the Jews began December 1st, when Mark Fields effectively began running the 109-year-old international auto firm as its COO. Fields, who is 51, has been lauded for his intelligence, skill, and dedication to Ford. He's worked all over the world for Ford, including a stint as the CEO of Mazda, which is controlled by Ford. In early November, Bill Ford, the executive chairman and the great-grandson of Henry, announced the appointment of Fields. That makes him the heir apparent for the CEO post when Alan Mulally retires in 2014. Fields was bar mitzvahed at a conservative synagogue in Paramus, New Jersey, as a graduate of Rutgers and the Harvard Business School. He maintains that he has never encountered any discrimination or anti-Semitism at Ford. Well, the original Henry Ford, the anti-Semitic founder, is likely rolling over in his grave watching a Jew take the reins of his famous company. But history books will have to continue to note Henry Ford's discriminatory writings and practices and his company's ties to the Nazis during the Holocaust. But the Ford Motor Company of the 21st century has continued the redemptive process started by its founder's descendants. A nice Hanukkah present from Ford Motor Company, a Jewish CEO to come. In that spirit, we continue our Hanukkah musical celebration with a contemporary song from my friend Rabbi Joe Black. It's called Judah Maccabee.
Time ago, in a land called Modin, lived a young man named Judah, brave and serene. When Antiochus the tyrant said the Jews could not be free, he didn't count on Judah, the one called Maccabee. In the window, shining so bright, I can see those Hanukkah lights, and it gives me such a warm, friendly glow when I think of Judah Maccabee so long ago. Now Judah and his brothers, they said it wasn't right to take away their freedom. They knew they had to fight. They fought 3 long years till the king could take no more. They rebuilt the holy temple, its beauty they restored. In the window, shining so bright, I can see the Hanukkah light, and it gives me such a warm, friendly, when I think of Judah Maccabee.
That was Rabbi Joe Black singing his song Judah Maccabee for Hanukkah. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Chag Chanukah Sameach, Echolim leChanukah, Happy Hanukkah.
Chanukah Sameach. And a tasty Hanukkah.
Of course. Now, Israel is the country, besides the United States, where Hanukkah is a major Jewish holiday. The rest of the world, besides, I guess, Canada too, probably, doesn't think of Hanukkah as particularly important. But in Israel, it really is a major festival.
I think the main point in Israel about Hanukkah is that Hanukkah is probably the most Zionist holiday of all. The story of the Maccabees fighting for their freedom, fighting for their right to be a people, controlling themselves, governing themselves, living their lives as they want to live it in their land, is very much the story of the Zionist movement, of the modern state of Israel. It's the story of standing for who we are and not just accepting the fact that we need to live as a small minority, maybe at the diaspora, obey rules of others, and so on and so forth, but the concept of basically being a free people in our land, like in Hatikva, Am Chofshi Be'artzenu. And I think Hanukkah brings this story to life. It creates a symbol of what does it mean to be a free people in our land. I also think that it brings all the complexities of being a free people in our land. Because if you are a free people in your land, if you are the government, you have more responsibilities, you have more moral dilemmas. You can't, for example, just say, okay, whoever wants to be Jewish, be Jewish. You need to have a regulation. Who can be Jewish? Who can be your citizen, for example? You need to handle issues of security. Just like the Maccabees had to handle issues of security or fighting for their rights, you need to protect your people. And even the miracle of the oil, the story of the oil for the temple, brings a lot of those aspects to life. Suddenly, when you are the government, when you are controlling your people in your land, you need to handle economics. You need to handle to provide your people. And I think all of that comes to life in Hanukkah.
You know, one other piece, of course, which is that the Maccabees are a small, downtrodden group surrounded by hostile enemies, much larger armies, and managed to defeat them. That was certainly the case with Israel for the first decades of its existence. Not as true today.
Well, I think Israel is still surrounded by countries that, let's say, are not very friendly. We're looking at the Arab world and larger than the Arab world. If we are referring also to Iran, we're talking about more than 400 million people in an area of land that is bigger than the United States, control 30% of the world's oil, and most of that region is hostile to Israel. I just want to conclude with another funny element about Hanukkah that we kind of neglect usually. When we're looking at the dreidel, the sevivon, as we call it in Hebrew. Here in the state, you have the Nes Gadol HaYasham, Nun Samech Hey Shin.
Nes Gadol, Nun Gimel Hey Shin.
Right, sorry. And
I love to correct Israelis on Hebrew. This is very special for me.
Basically,
it's a miracle of Hanukkah here.
A big miracle happened there. In Israel, instead of the Shin, we have a Pei, which is Po, here. A big miracle happened here, because that's where the story took place. That's where it really began.
And those dreidels are collector's items in the United States and very highly prized. Chag Chanukah Sameach, Guy. We'll talk
Chanukah
next week.
Chanukah Sameach.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Chag Sameach. Tom, happy Hanukkah. Good morning.
Good morning. Chag Sameach to you.
We were talking last week, and we should continue that discussion, about the prevalence of anti-Semitism, particularly in the wake of things like the Gaza war, but how it seems to continue to be a Jewish problem in Europe especially.
Yeah, and I would say not so much the prevalence as the persistence. I mean, it's just been around for so many centuries, and there have been times in history like the Renaissance or the Enlightenment or the French Revolution when Jews had reason to hope that anti-Semitism had finally bitten the dust. And then they were disappointed every time. You know, roughly 100 years after the French Revolution, along comes the Dreyfus trial, and all those old ghosts come out of the cemetery.
In Paris, of all places.
Right. So I want to make your listeners aware that religion in general, of which the Jewish question, as it's often referred to in Europe, is a small piece, remains a profound problem for the European Union. As Europe seeks closer integration, it has tried several times to write a constitution for the Union, and it has stumbled each time because of the insistence on the part of certain countries that a preamble or an opening thing like, you know, in our founding documents, there's a line about every individual has certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Okay, they want sort of a preambular statement like that that characterizes Europe as having a Christian culture or having a Christian soul. So, first of all, there's the age-old problem between Catholics and Protestants. Now, with the expansion of the European Union toward the East, there's also a problem between Roman Catholics and Orthodox Christians. So it's a three-way tussle among Christians to decide what, in fact, is Christian. But the more, I would say, progressive or liberated or multi-ethnic societies in Western Europe realize that to define Europe as having a Christian culture is to exclude many of their citizens from full participation in society or in the building of the European vision, because there are many Muslims and many Jews and many other non-Christians living in Western Europe. You take a country like France or Germany or Holland or England, and there's countless people who are not Christian. And so these countries actually have dug in their feet and said no. So the whole project of creating a constitution and thereby deepening and reinforcing the structure of the European Union is sort of on hold over what religion. Seems like a question that should have been resolved a long time ago, but in fact is still a front burner issue for many Europeans. So it should not surprise anyone that when there's a chance or a reason to slam Jews and say, see, they're not really like us, that happens from one end of Europe to the other. Obviously not universally. Obviously not everybody in Europe feels this way. But it happens enough to reawaken some very bad and painful memories in Jewish communities throughout the continent.
Yeah, it's stunning. I mean, this time it was from Barcelona to Copenhagen to Budapest to you name it. It was sort of all around the continent. Not horrible, no, thank God, no terrible, terrible incidents, but just another reminder, you're right, the persistence. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Morris is giving advice to his newly married son. David, he says, my one piece of advice to you is this. As you go through life with Sarah, never, ever criticize her faults. Why do you say that, Dad? Asked David. Because it might have been these faults of hers, these little imperfections, that prevented her from getting a better husband. That was the Old Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion continues the heart of the Joseph story. It's always around Hanukkah that we read the great story of Joseph. Joseph is the principal character of the last four weekly portions in Genesis, and the tale itself has been called the first truly modern piece of literature, which is particularly impressive since it was written at least 2,500 years ago, and most would add a millennium or so to that number. In this week's portion of Miketz, dreams play a central role, not for the first time in Genesis and not for the first time in Joseph's story. In Miketz, the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, dreams a famous dream. Seven fat cows emerge from the Nile River, and they are then eaten by seven skinny cows. Then seven fat ears of grain are devoured by seven lean ears of grain. But what can it all mean? None of the Egyptian king's brilliant advisors or counselors can help him. Apparently, his cabinet selection team failed him in those days. In desperation, the Pharaoh turns to a forgotten Hebrew prisoner who once helped his chief wine steward, that is, the Pharaoh's bartender, when he was in jail. Joseph is dragged from prison, cleaned up, and brought to the Pharaoh, perhaps the most powerful man in the entire world at the time. He hears the dream and correctly interprets it, prophesying 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine. Giving full credit to God for being his only source of insight, Joseph helps the Pharaoh to save Egypt, and things go well both for him and Egypt. He rises to great prominence, second in command of the whole country, and the Pharaoh's power is multiplied while his people are saved from destruction. Joseph marries and has two children, but oddly, his great success and his fame throughout Egypt and the new family aren't quite enough for Joseph. He misses his father, left behind in Canaan, and pines for his younger brother Benjamin, the only reminder of his dead mother, Rachel. Joseph never expects to see them again. And then, in a plot twist worthy of the best novelists, Joseph's brothers are compelled by famine to come down to Egypt to buy bread. Suddenly, the same characters who beat him and sold him into slavery are completely in his power. What an amazing opportunity for revenge. And in this week's Torah portion of Miketz, Joseph seems to be ready to take advantage of it. He teases and torments his brothers, he fully aware of their identity and they completely ignorant of his. What will happen? As the Torah portion concludes, we're left wondering just which way it will all go. Next week, we'll get the answer. Ah, but this week, the issue is delineated. How exactly will an assimilated Jew respond to the pressure to hide his identity? Just as the Jews in the days of the Maccabees struggled with tremendous pressure to accept cultural subjugation and give up their Judaism, so too Joseph struggled with hiding his identity or admitting it in public. In a season in which the majority culture can overwhelm us with its songs, foods, and religious trappings, we Jews too sometimes struggle to assert our pride in our own Jewish identities. May we learn from the lessons of Joseph and the Maccabees that Jewish identity must be asserted proudly and with pleasure in every season. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest Moshe Bar-El will describe what it's like to grow and harvest olives while Palestinian terrorist rockets land all around you. Find out here on Two Jewish in a moment.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution granting Palestine a non-member observer state status at the UN, in spite of opposition from Israel and the United States. The Palestinians hope the recognition will provide new leverage in final status negotiations with Israel, whenever those might resume, if ever. The vote was 138 delegates in favor of the measure, 9 against, and 41 abstentions. Voting no, that is, supporting Israel's position, were Canada, the Czech Republic, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Nauru, Palau, Panama, and the United States, and of course Israel. The 41 abstentions included England, Germany, and about half the European states, as well as Australia, Korea, and some others. This vote for observer status was largely symbolic. It gave Palestine something like the same status the Vatican has. Not really a country, but with more representation. The UN, of course, has not been a positive place for Israel or, well, for friends of truth or honesty or effectiveness for a long time. While Israel strongly objected to this move, I don't believe it will ultimately have much meaning, so long as the UN Security Council refuses to allow the nation of Palestine to be admitted officially. Most of this is just posturing. The key, of course, is the U.S. veto in the Security Council, which remains steadfast. Sadly, after much pressure from pro-Palestinian groups and a recommendation from the United Nations, Stevie Wonder decided not to perform at the annual Friends of the Israel Defense Forces Gala, December 6th in Los Angeles. FIDF National Director and CEO Jerry Gershon didn't think much of the decision. We regret the fact that Stevie Wonder has decided to cancel his performance at an important community event of the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces, an American organization supporting the educational, cultural, and well-being needs of Israel's soldiers, their families, and the families of fallen soldiers. The FIDF is a non-political organization providing much-needed humanitarian support regardless of religion, political affiliation, or military activity. You know, to be totally honest, I had no idea that Stevie Wonder was still alive, let alone performing music, although not for this. In politics, there's some further information on spending in the recent campaigns. 2 years ago, Jewish Las Vegas and Asian casino magnate Sheldon Adelson vowed to spend as much as $100 million to defeat President Barack Obama and to help the GOP, the Republicans, take control of Congress. According to sources now, however, the billionaire not only made good on that promise, he went well beyond. Adelson ultimately upped the ante, spending closer to something like $150 million, including between $30 and $40 million given to the Karl Rove-founded Crossroads GPS, as well as at least $15 million to grassroots efforts with financial links to Charles and David Koch. Among other major beneficiaries of Adelson's largesse were the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which got about $5 million, and the Republican Jewish Coalition, which got the bulk of its $6.5 million budget from Adelson. Unlike the super PACs that raked in $54 million in funds from Adelson and his wife, all of these are nonprofits, which are not currently required to disclose their donors. Adelson's public spending spree, larger than any other donor's in the previous election, was made possible by two high court rulings in early 2010 that allowed corporations, unions, and individuals to write unlimited checks to outside groups for political ads and other activities backing candidates. In Washington, D.C., they held a retirement event at the Israeli embassy honoring Joe Lieberman, who is completing 24 years in the Senate representing Connecticut. Israeli Ambassador Michael Oren likened Joe Lieberman to his biblical namesake, the patriarch Joseph, of this week's Torah portion. A taste of humor in the evening came while Michael Oren was counting down both Joe Lieberman and our patriarch Joseph's attributes that they shared: loyalty, independent leadership, love of family. Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, the departing Israeli defense minister, wondered aloud whether modern-day Joseph had, like his namesake, gotten into trouble with a married woman in the court. "We're not going there," Oren said. Senator John McCain of Arizona, Lieberman's longtime traveling companion, was the biggest hit of the night. He said that after putting up with all the Orthodox stuff for all these years, he is now officially converted to Judaism. But some things still puzzle McCain. He started by talking about Shabbat elevators, whose point he never quite got. Pushing all those buttons and nothing. Then McCain got to the dining. "Why in every kosher menu do we have to have the bleeping salmon?" he said to peals of laughter. And then he talked about the long walks on winter Sabbaths accompanying Lieberman home from the Senate. "And that time McCain fell asleep on a plane ride. I hear this mumbling and I look and there's this guy wearing a shawl. I thought maybe I died." Lieberman in his own speech got in a zinger of a rejoinder. "John, your entry into the covenant was a lot less painful than mine." The most impressive part of the evening came when Israeli Ambassador Michael Oren, a past guest of Two Jewish, handed Joe Lieberman a gift-wrapped book. "It's a Bible," he said. Lieberman took it and said, "I've already read it." And Oren added, "It's a signed copy." Hoo-ha! A wistful final note, the great American Jewish novelist Philip Roth announced last week that he has finally officially retired from writing. After 31 books in 5 years, Roth decided at age 79 he no longer had anything important to say, and he no longer had the endurance to struggle with the frustration of discarding two-thirds of what he writes, his normal pattern. Roth's last novel will have been the 2012 book Nemesis. Philip Roth's retirement announcement is in somewhat startling contrast to the 97-year-old American Jewish novelist Herman Wouk, who recently completed his own novel, The Lawgiver, about Moses, and is still going strong. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. Our brothers, our brothers. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. He's agronomist Moshe Barel, who is head of a laboratory in Israel, as well as for a hobby, he has 800 olive trees. 700, I don't want to exaggerate. Tell us a little bit about what it takes to become an agronomist. You know, we have a kind of romantic idea of the farmers who reclaimed Eretz Yisrael for the Zionists, but it's a complicated technical scientific pursuit now.
Well, usually agriculture goes with me from a very young age. I was educated at an agricultural school called Mikveh Israel. This is the first agricultural school that was founded in Israel, founded in 1870. And many are graduated this school. After agricultural school, I went to the army, and I was trained as a soldier and a commander for about a year. And after that, I was chosen to be an agriculture instructor in the Nahal. Nahal is a brigade that is called Noar Chalutzi Lochem. Lochem, that means fighting Chalutzi.
Pioneers.
And then I instructed soldiers that were intended first to be in a kibbutz, learn agriculture, and after that to establish new kibbutzim along the front of Israel.
So explain for our listeners the difference between a kibbutz and a moshav. I don't think everybody knows, and of course in modern Israel it's somewhat different.
Well, I live in the moshav. A moshav is private farmers. Each farmer has his own small farm and usually cultivated by himself and by his family, and sometimes with the help of other workers. A kibbutz is a community that all the farm belongs to all the people. They share the work in kibbutzim, and all the profits are distributed between the members.
So it's not so much collective in the way that a kibbutz, where people don't really have possession, it's more of a cooperative.
Yes, it's a cooperative, but all the intellectual life are together. They are like a small community doing everything together.
When you talk to Israelis today, you know, for a long time, in the early days of both the yeshuv and the early days of the state, and for a while after, the kibbutz and the moshav were kind of an ideal. That's how all Israelis believed that everybody should live. Of course, it's a different world today, whether people are in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or Haifa or in high tech or whatever it is that they're doing. Is the romance gone from agriculture in Israel?
Yes, the kibbutzim have a little change a bit. For instance, the money is not shared equal between the members, but everyone has like a salary. According to his work, he's getting his money.
Israel is world famous for its desert agriculture, for the way it handles water. Talk a little bit about how that plays into your work.
Well, usually in Israel, you can't spend a lot of water. You have to save water. So in Israel, developed a method of conserving water, and we use what we call drip irrigation. That means there is a pipe with very tiny holes, and the water comes out very slowly, so the evaporation of the water wouldn't be quick, and most of the water will stay in the ground.
Israel is a very small country, especially for an agricultural country, and yet some of its produce and the specific advances it has made are world famous, and its stuff is desired all over Europe, all over the world. What is it that makes it so special?
Well, in Israel, the farmers are much more sophisticated than other countries. They are more educated. And now, the most important export of Israel, we call it a suitcase export. That means we will export less products, but more seeds, more knowledge, more technology, more electronic for agriculture. So this is thing that we can benefit all the world.
So highly sophisticated aspects that improve agriculture everywhere.
Yes, especially in the irrigation field. There is a very big factory in Kibbutz Chatzerim. It's no Netafim. And they are producing a lot of equipment for irrigation, and they have some facilities in other countries also.
You're in a part of the country where it's fairly common for rockets to be sent over and to land in your fields. What's it like trying to do agriculture in those conditions?
Okay, we are now going back to the...
Back to politics.
Yeah, no, back to the Israeli history when you have to have in one hand a rifle and the other hand a shovel. So we suffer from it. And for instance, when I was in the olive orchard and the rocket was very close, so I just stood close to the olive tree, and I'm sure that the olive tree was defended me from the rocket. Mm. So it's not easy, especially we worry very much for the small children, for the grandchildren. But this is the way how we have to live, and we will do it anyway.
It's very Israeli attitude.
Yeah.
Not like there's a choice. You know, olive trees, which is your hobby, they're so strongly tied to the land of Israel, to the Bible, one of the Shivat Aminim, the seven species that typify ancient Israeli agriculture. What does it feel like to grow an olive tree, to produce olives from an olive tree?
Yeah, it's like coming back to history. And olive things is a thing that you come very attached to it. You know that the olive tree can live up to 1,000 years or more. And whatever in Israel, you're going to the Arab village, to the Jewish village, you will always find the olive trees.
When you produce your olive oil, is it, I assume it's at an extremely high level of quality. How does it, what's the system for getting it into the market? What's the role of the agronomist in beginning that process?
Well, usually I'm a small olive oil producer, but I have very loyal people that are buying from me every year, and most of my olive are sold to family, friends, and people I know.
Even with 700 trees?
Yes.
People eat a lot of olives in Israel.
Yes. Well, it come every year it come bigger and bigger, and more people like the olive oil, and the usage is expanding every year.
All right, I have a question that's always bothered me. See, I get to ask you all these questions I've been thinking about for a long time.
Okay.
An olive in its native state is totally inedible, right? It's some of them are even poisonous. Somehow you have to cure it. If you're going to eat the olive, you put it in salt or lye or something. How did they figure this out?
Well, there is many different methods to cultivate, but there are very old methods. There are hundreds of ways you can make the olives suitable for eating. But the first step is to take out the bitterness from the oil, olives, and you can do it many ways. Usually you put it in water and you change the water about 7 or 10 times. Then you can make from it pickles for eating.
Fascinating. I just wonder about the first person who said, you know, if I soak this 7 or 8 times and then put it in salt, then it'll come out really good and I can eat it. I mean, very interesting.
Yes, this is the method.
You have children and grandchildren.
Yes.
Do you want them to be in your profession?
To grow olive trees, of course. But I can decide about their future. I hope even only one of my sons or grandsons will keep doing it, I will be very happy.
What is the specialty of the laboratory that you supervise?
I manage a laboratory that supplies the farmer, the dairy farm in Israel, with artificial insemination.
So I don't need you to describe that for our audience, but you know, what percentage, I mean, we don't think about this unless we happen to be in agriculture, which not so many Jews are in America. What percentage of cows, how many of the cows are actually go through the process of artificial insemination?
Oh, no, in Israel it's about 99%, because the Israeli dairy farm is very modern. There's a lot of electronics. Usually each farmer has a computer. Each farmer can go to any cow in the country. And all the information is available. There is a Israeli.
So are they, do they chip cows? Do they put a digital chip in each cow, or they just have a code?
Yes, wow. They can put a chip in the ear, or right. They have a pad that they put on the leg of the cow.
No kidding.
And when the cow is coming to be milking, she is on the computer, and you can see all the statistics about the cows. And when she's milk, you are instantly can see how milk she produced in this special milking.
So very sophisticated.
Yes, and the Israeli cows are on the first place in the world in the milk production.
Amazing, some of the accomplishments, the scientific accomplishments of agriculture. What makes you happiest in your field?
In the dairy field?
In any of the fields that you work in, what do you like the best?
Well, when I see a bottle of olive oil, it makes me happy. When I see a cow with a lot of milk, it makes me happy. When I see a young calf, a male or a female, which is so beautiful, I'm happy. And on these days, we got a letter from Gaza because we supply them with semen for cows. And they as just wrote us a very nice letter and a very nice picture of a cow, which was the cow and the first calf that was born from Israeli semen in the Gaza Strip.
So now there's Arab cows from Israeli semen in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, they are saying moo in Arabic.
I want to thank Moshe Barel for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be, for the very last day of Hanukkah, the 2012 MacArthur Genius Fellowship winner, Professor Maria Chudnovsky of Columbia University. Our playout this morning for Hanukkah is called She'asa Nisim, May the One Who Makes Miracles. My friends, have a Chag Chanukah Sameach, a happy, healthy, and delightful festival of lights. And may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Everybody's looking round, hoping to find a miracle. In our search we pass right by the many wonders in our lives. A child is born, a baby's cry, a flower blooms, the sun is sky. It's all a gift, a special gift for me. She'asa nisim l'avotenu bayamim ahem. Man azeh she'asa nisim l'avotenu bayamim ahem. Man azeh.
As we light the candle,
candles every night. We think of all the miracles, how the Maccabim few but brave beat the Yevanim.